Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. All right, Mike Novogratz, welcome to Delphi's Clubhouse. Just to let you know, it's being recorded. I have to tell you legally. How's it going?
I'm doing all right.
It's great to do this in person. First interview in a long time in person. What about you?
Yeah, I'm ready for COVID to end, so I've declared it over. much to the chagrin of my kids, who are like, Dad, I've had COVID, so I feel like I won't be able to give it to you.
But, did you have it bad? I had it. It was a tough weekend. But
I didn't have it so bad, but I infected a lot of people, so that was kind of shitty. And so you feel all the stress of like having to call people. But after I got it, I felt better.
Yeah. Now, what do you, think we'll be back by the summer?
I do. I think, you know, Biden's going to say today, May 1st, every adult can have a vaccine. Almost everyone I know in the city who wanted a vaccine has gotten one. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're going to see, you know, it rained vaccines in April. And you got the good weather coming out, spring. I mean, even today, you know, the city feels like it wants to go.
It does. I mean, back to 50%. Well, I mean, you think eventually vaccines and just everyone already having antibodies will inflect somewhere, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because this bill that came out today, you know, they're putting all this money in for testing and we're not going to need testing. Everyone's going to be vaccinated. We're not going to need masks. We're not going to need testing. We're not going to need this whole elaborate plan to bring the schools back online. We needed that last year.
Yep.
Not this year. Politicians are like one year late. But I think, you know, by summer, we'll have a normal summer. People will be traveling. The Hamptons will be ripping. The city will be popping.
You think all the people that moved to far away out of the city, into the country, Puerto Rico, all over, are going to come back to New York?
I think most, certainly under 30 will. Like, what in God's name are you going to be under 30 and living in the summer?
I can't wait for Brooklyn Open.
I think under 30, the city is going to boom. I do think there's some, you know, two kids, 34, wife likes living in the suburbs. You know, some of those guys or women are going to get stuck. My guess is the city comes roaring back.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for it. So, Mike, you built an incredibly large business. You've seen a lot of stories, a lot of projects, a lot of people. Not to be redundant here, but how does it feel? You know, did you ever think Galaxy would be this big at this point?
You know, it feels good. I call it Galaxy 2.0. You know, we went in 2018, really, and started this, had this idea of building this Goldman Sachs of crypto, we called it, or then I switched it to the Drexel of crypto, which I got all kinds of shit for because, you know, Drexel didn't end so well. But Drexel did. I mean, Mike Milken really was the guy who helped credentialize, you know, high yield junk bonds. And I thought part of our job was to be credentializers, to, you know, bring the institutional world into the crypto space. And, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, we were way too early and, you know, made some, you know, internal mistakes. It had an okay business, but not a great business. And we're given a second lease on life, literally with COVID, as horrible as that sounds. All of us in crypto were, right? COVID gave Bitcoin an amazing macro story. And it gave the rest of crypto this idea of the digitalization of everything in hyperspeed. And we were smart to notice there was a shift, both from positioning, but also hiring. And so, you know, since then, we have hired a tremendous amount of talented people. And right now, it feels great. I walked in last week, and there were 5 new employees, and each one was like hungrier and smarter than the next. And I was like, okay, we're getting this now. You know, I used to always say we need to hire younger people, and I'd get yelled at for being an ageist. And, you know, what I should have been saying is we need to hire crypto native people, like people that actually care about crypto, that know how to stake, that are looking at the new projects that are. And, you know, it's interesting because Wall Street, we have our president has Volvo signs in his office because with our institutional customers, we got to be safe. So they want to drive a Volvo. And so I laugh now. I wear a hoodie one day and a suit the next. With rallies, I wear hoodies probably 4 days a week.
That's what you're meaning.
But it's this we're straddling this line between institutions and they want things buttoned up in crypto, which is kind of like a middle finger to the system and trying to push the edge of regulation and, you know, And so it's an interesting place to be.
Do you hire, you know, the DeFi degens for the research, and then you hire the guys to deal with the institutions? What's the switch?
You know, it's interesting. I love DeFi, and we've got a great team there. If I called them degens on the radio, they would yell at me. We're having a lot more collaboration between both the institutional, you know, the traditional institutional guys, because I want to be the smartest guys in the room. Like, you guys want to be the smartest guys in the room. And I think sometimes you are. Everyone wants to be the smartest guys in the room. So how do you get your firm to be smart? You get cross integration, right? You get cross fertilization. And so even if I'm talking to a client that I know is just going to buy Bitcoin, if I can take him down the same rabbit hole that most people on this call have gone through, hey, I started with Bitcoin, understand what a blockchain was. What is the Ethereum? What are the other alternatives to Ethereum? What's built on top of Ethereum? What's DeFi all about? What are stable coins? If I can take him on that journey, he's going to feel smarter to his bosses. He's going to like me as a client better. And we're going to get a much better chance of getting other business, as these guys inevitably will go on the same journey.
Agreed. And, you know, personal question, but I'll ask anyway, how do you scale a business that large that requires such specific intellect and knowledge per person, right? Like, you have a ton of employees, but, you know, how do you get the knowledge from that DeFi degen over that the guy that has to impress the large institution? It's hard.
You know, it's a great question, and we're still working on it. Like, in Galaxy 1.0, we had, you know, one of my young, brilliant guys, Luca, do this Project Alexandria, where he literally did a library of every kind of crypto concept, you know, simple blockchain stuff, snarks, you name it. It was on in this library, and people were supposed to kind of do, you know, it was like a study guide for the employees. That doesn't really work. We tried.
It's on hands on. Yeah.
And so
it's cool though.
It was a good idea. It didn't work. I mean, it worked a little bit, but, and so it's literally finding ways to work together, and it's hiring people that care. I mean, that's a big, big part of it. And so it's people that, and listen, the world has changed immensely in the last 3 months. And if there's one message to give tonight that might have some profundity, I'm not even sure that's the right word, is that 3-4 months ago, when you entered a career in crypto, you were taking career risk.
Yeah.
People, it wasn't a thing yet. And in the last 4 months, it's 100% become an asset class. It's become an asset class in a way that surprises me even as a bull. Yeah. Every major bank is now completely engaged. We were just about to hire a guy from one of the major, the biggest banks in the world. And he was about to come, and he's not now because they've just offered him to be the head of a 25-person group to compete against us. I was like, oh, great.
Good luck to them.
And so if it's JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or UBS, they're all now engaging in crypto. And it's going to start in the wealth channel for a lot of them, but it's going to go much faster in other places. JP Morgan is petrified of stablecoins, right? They make $12 billion a year, $12 billion a year on their cross-border payments business, right? All these big foreign exchange banks, it's, you know, you're a corporate and you want to send money from Vietnam to Norway, they take a lot of money out of that. And so, matter of fact, I was told that they've just, JP's just added $3 billion to their tech budget, added because of this problem. They're trying to hire as many engineers as they can in the blockchain space. And so it's game on now. It's game on for Apple and Microsoft and Facebook, we all read about, right? Diem's coming. I think it's becoming accepted that in 5 years' time, people won't have bank accounts, they'll have wallets. And people will feel that their money is just as safe in a wallet as they used to feel in a bank account. And I don't know if it's 5 years' time or 7 years' time or 3 years' time, but it's definitely happening. And so the good news is for people that decided to make a career in crypto, you've got a career. You know, it might not disappear in 4 months. Where it felt like it was disappearing in 2018 and even, you know, in the crash of 2020, people were like, oh, I can't believe that happened again. I can't believe Ethereum's under 100.
Hey, mom, lend me $1,000. I got to pay rent.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, and now their parents' houses.
And now there's a career. And that's a big deal because it allows firms like ours and yours to hire a different group of people. you don't only have to have the really frontier fringe guys, mm-hmm. right, who really have seen it themselves. You can hire great human capital and you can walk them there. And that's what we're seeing.
So how do you think about the banks, though? Like, it feels to me like JP Morgan could spend $1 zillion, you know, acquiring projects, companies, people, but I don't feel like they'll ever have the cultural shift until it really hurts their pockets. Like,
so I always thought the banks were being foolish about Bitcoin because Bitcoin wasn't a threat to the banks, right? If anything, it was a threat to the gold producers and the gold funds, but it wasn't a threat to the banks. It was just another asset. They should have traded it. They should asset managed it. It was a very profitable niche business if they could have done it. They felt it was like this existential threat. DeFi is an existential threat to the banks. And it goes right after them, right? And I think they're going to have a really hard time competing against DeFi in the long run. Because of that, like, they're not dumb. You watch, they're going to play dirty when it comes to leveraging their relationships with regulators and, you know, throwing smoke into the room. And so, and part of it is, you know, we did a deal with a bank today, and we had to indemnify something. I got a DocuSign, and it was 179 pages long.
You're supposed to read that?
I was like, 179 pages long, like, well, for some little piece of a deal.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of replacing that with code.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, replacing all those people who feel like I need to jam that guy because it'll make me look good to my boss. Or
so operational heavy, so bureaucratic. It's so slow.
Yeah. So when we get to the world of driverless insurance companies and driverless banks and driverless exchanges. I mean, I have a not a big enough position in Sushi and Uniswap. I'm fascinated, right? Like, and they haven't cracked the KYC piece of that yet, but there are a lot of smart people working on the KYC piece. And I think once that's cracked, I keep scratching my head. I was like, why isn't that going to be the biggest exchange? Now, listen, we've got high valuations in DeFi already. And so you're not buying things cheap anymore. But I do think it's the most exciting area. But that's the area that should scare the hell out of Wall Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Bitcoin shouldn't.
It's kind of ironic seeing SushiSwap and Uniswap trade on Coinbase. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, here's liquidity for your competitor. Yeah.
That's a good point, actually.
Yeah, it's funny to see. It's, well, I mean, Mackey and Hayden are two, you know, emperors of the space, right? They're going head-to-head with two very different communities now. So it's going to be interesting to see it play out. What's your favorite DeFi project or, you know, favorite couple, favorite sector? You don't have to shout one out, but, you know, what's super exciting to you in the DeFi space that, you know, you've been around a while and you say, hey, this is just straight up.
Listen, I, you know, at its core, Compound even, right? Like, you know, just rethinking the interest rate market, having a spot interest rate market is, if there's a guy who spent his life in fixed income and in foreign exchange, I was like, what do you mean spot interest rates? Yeah. That alone was kind of like a mind-blowing, you know, insight. And I think the foundation of all finance is the interest rate curve, right? And so I think that's a foundational piece of architecture.
What do you think about the yield? Like, Compound also kicked off yield farming, basically, because they were one of the full synthetics did it, like, real early on. But Compound was the first to offer a native governance token for using your platform, lending, borrowing. Now it's obviously, you know, teams are giving out their yield farming rewards in 2 weeks to everyone. Do you think yield farming is basically just marketing money at the end of the day, or do you think it's actual real incentives? Do you think it drives lock-in? How do you kind of think about that?
You know, it happened, well, when the big money was made in it, it happened so fast, it was just Ponzi.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't use the word Ponzi so explicit, but how do you pull the next guy in? How do you pull the next guy in? And it's interesting, again, from a institutional perspective, if you're regulated, you know, the KYC piece of these things are really difficult. So, like, we can invest in those companies, but we're not using them in every case, you know, unless we really can understand who we're trading against. I think it's going to have legs. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get 40% yields.
No. It's funny. Our team laughs when we see 400%. We're like, is it really worth our time and gas fees for 400% a year?
The other thing I think is, and this is going to sound arrogant, and so I apologize to everybody for sounding arrogant. We have a very young community that learns fast, but still very young. And So new ideas, people come surging in and often don't think through all the risks. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking earlier about Celsius or BlockFi or all these lending platforms. To me, it makes absolutely zero sense to lend Bitcoin, which is a 100 vol asset, to somebody to make 3.5 to 4% extra. Like, it's the theater of the absurd, especially when you're taking their credit risk.
Yep.
You're an unsecured creditor to a highly leveraged, like, and again, that's, even if you were taking no credit risk, 400, you know, 25 times your vol, same. Like, or ETH trading at 140 vol. And so just as a trader, and listen, no one's losing yet.
Yeah.
And so when everyone's winning, everything looks good. When you get losses, either credit losses or the opportunity cost of being able to sell your, you know, you lock up your Bitcoin and then it spikes like crazy. You want to sell it and it's locked up. You can't sell it. It makes no sense to me.
I've driven home in the middle of the night for my girlfriend's many nights when I thought something was getting hacked or rugged or something. How do you, just going back to Galaxy and DeFi, a lot of the like life-changing amounts of money or generational wealth is when, you know, some kid, some guy puts 10 grand into a brand new project, turns to $1 million. That doesn't really matter to a big firm. How do you keep your eye on DeFi where it matters, but also where it's worth it financially to invest?
So, like, so listen, we have a great team. We got a guy named Michael Jordan.
Amazing guy.
The white Michael Jordan. Who perhaps has no basketball skills, but was one hell of a skier. Literally, he's like a fucking wicked rocket going down the mountain. You know, a guy named John Cole, Will Nelly. We got these guys, they've got a mission, and the mission is to, you know, get us into the best projects. And so it's hard to get in those projects, right? You have Paradigm and Polychain, and all these guys wanted to get in those projects. And so you've got to have something to offer them.
Yeah.
Guys that really care and understand the project. We have an ability to bring publicity and to bring Wall Street, you know, into those projects. And so that's something to add. But, you know, it's a fight. It's a fight to get in the best projects. And so it's the team we're putting resources into. And you know, right now it's been great. These guys they're doing a great job. And so, yeah, we can't put $100,000. Does make it less sense, but we can put $1 million or $2 million into projects. And then, you know, some of these things, you put $2 million in, $4 million in it, it can be life-changing.
I see A16Z go to small DeFi projects and the valuations, you know, 10x overnight.
I'm, yeah.
You know, is it really worth it at that point? So, Mike, I guess when you're thinking about portfolio sizing, not for Galaxy, but for everyone listening, how do you think through, what would your advice be to young people in DeFi that are investing? Ultra-concentrated, diversified?
You know, it's really different when you're young in some ways because, you know, assuming you have a job, right? Assuming you have a job and your job isn't just investor, which I know a lot of people now are making so much money in crypto, they decide they're just investors. I think that's pretty dangerous.
Overnight scholars.
Yeah. It all looks good in a bull market.
Yep.
I think, you know, when you're under 35, you're supposed to take some risk.
Yeah.
And so that's more concentration, not less concentration. The biggest thing, though, if you want to do well is entry point. Right? You can't FOMO. I missed it, but I'm going to buy it way up here. Mm-hmm. You got to do your homework and get in at a decent valuation before the big move starts. And then the hardest part is riding the big move. Right? It's just, you got to so you got to have some pre-arranged strategy. Hey, I'm going to take a 12th off. Take my bases back. But you got to let.
You got to have a plan.
You got to have a plan.
Yeah.
And there are. This is one of the few places it's like venture capital returns that you sometimes get in 6 months. We were talking about Luna token, right? It's gone from 20 cents to $11. That's 55x in 5 months. So you start thinking, God, if I only put $1 million in, it's 55 million. All right, you don't have $1 million. So I put 10,000 in, it's a shack load of money.
Yeah, it's a big difference. Huge.
55 times. Yeah. You're buying a Ferrari if you want. And so, but you know, it's really hard to hold. And so, but make a plan in advance.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I guess when you you have so much finance and traditional Wall Street experience. When you meet these founders, you know, some of them are anonymous, some of them are well known. What do you, it just seems like you and their lifestyles will be so different. Your advice, you know, how do you meet, how, where do you meet them in the middle?
You know, my clothes, I went out with Tarun. Have you ever gone out with Tarun? He's got wacky.
I wish I did.
He's got wackier. Yeah. He's got wackier clothes than I have. You know,
you look pretty normal.
Listen, for me, it's a learning experience. I got back into having a business because I said, can I work with young people? Yes. Will I learn a bunch? Yes. And can I contribute something? And I hope it was yes. And so I'm trying to contribute to them some wisdom of a 56-year-old guy that's been through a bunch of cycles and that understands markets and has a pretty good view of what, you know, macro guys predict the future. And I've had a pretty good ability to sense what's coming. And then I'm learning all the awesome details of how that future is going to change from these young guys that are building these new platforms.
Mike, if I polled everyone at Galaxy, every employee, what would they say is the advice that they learned from you? Just an aggregate, like greatest piece of advice you think that they come away with, whether they stay, go, et cetera.
I don't know if they'd say this. I would hope they'd say this is like, you got to work on yourself. Like I always tell people, you know, you're not here for me. I already got five freaking houses, four kids, beautiful wife. Like I'm doing just fine.
You got it good. Yeah.
You got to work. And so you got to figure out like what you want to do, why you're here. You know, so everyone has to go on their own little therapy journey, not at Galaxy, in the planet, right? And there's so many different ways now to kind of learn about yourself, even from fun things like psilocybin and ayahuasca retreats to meditation, but do work at understanding what drives you. And that liberates you to then go forward with a lot more confidence and a lot more joy.
My sister's a psychologist. And she always says, you know, everyone should go to therapy, whether you need it or not.
It's a luxury.
Yep.
It used to be seen, therapy was seen as, oh my God, what's wrong with the guy? I was like, we need to be the generation. You need to be the generation that destigmatizes mental health. Like everyone should be lucky enough to have a therapist because it's kind of cool. You go for an hour and the guy like talks about you.
It's their one job.
It's their one job. Yeah. And there's no takeaway.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't follow you out. Right. It's just so it's a really unique.
You don't waste a week arguing with your wife over stuff. You know, spend the hour.
But there's lots of other things. If you can't afford therapy, right? I mean, there's meditation or prayer or travel. Like people say travel. Like, hey, when you travel, you realize that your way of life is just a way of life. It's not the way of life, right? You learn empathy because you're like, whoa, how did that? But mostly you realize this shell that you think is existence is just a story.
What was your favorite vacation, I guess? If you have to think through, I mean, it doesn't have to be recent, but.
I think everybody needs to go on vacations with their friends, even more so than family. You know, when you're young, your friends running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain with a bunch of guys or girls. For us, it was a bunch of guys chasing girls, not very successfully in Spain, but it was that was the fun, you know, drinking all night, running with the bulls. That was probably my favorite vacation.
I'm a big EDM ultra Burning Man guy, so I get it.
Yeah. With my family, my favorite vacations are safaris in Africa.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
It's, you know, going out there, you know, everyone goes there, has the same feeling. You're like, I've never thought I was so religious before. You know, there is something magical about, you know, sitting on the Serengeti.
So when do you do that? I guess for the younger people, like working 8 hours a day, like weekends, I guess bear markets.
No, you don't. You do the Africa trip when you got young kids.
Yeah.
You do the Ibiza trip when you're 28.
Amen.
There is a time and place for, and they got plenty of time. And even now, like working hard, you have to have some. But I told people, it's been such a great running crypto. Take some of your crypto, sell some, and buy yourself something that's going to make you smile.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's a new car or a cool suit or, you know, great kicks or something bigger.
That email from Sally Mae finally paid off my college loans.
Yeah. Or a house for your mom if you really are, you know, killing it. But that, you know, you can lose your way if you're just focused on stacking sats.
Yeah.
Or ETHs or whatever.
Way, I don't even know. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I like that. It's good life advice to kind of pull yourself out. I mean, we work so much all day long. We really don't realize that point of view ever.
You know? Yeah.
Sorry.
So yeah. A good sports car for the summer at your age, You know, that would be, if I was your age, that's what I'd be doing. I never had a good car until I was old, married, and rich. So maybe this is just me projecting.
Mike, if you need someone to take your car out for a weekend, I'm your guy. All right. And so just switching over, Mike, you do a ton of philanthropic work. A lot of it's about the justice system, changing that. What's the download there? What's the goal? What are you trying to achieve? What's wrong? And I'm not as cued in as I should be.
Listen, the reason I got so excited about crypto was because it really was about systems change. It was about, can we rebuild the financial infrastructure that the planet uses, actually the commercial infrastructure that the planet uses, in a more transparent, egalitarian way? You know, can you set something up that feels fair? And to me, that was cool as shit. And the spirit of the original people I met in crypto was burn it down, let's rebuild it, right? Mm-hmm. It was revolutionary. It was F you to the man.
Yeah.
And so that got me excited. I approached the criminal justice system the same way. It is such a fucked up system. Excuse the language. It's in the U.S., it's broken from its core. It's based on a mean-spiritedness. It emanates from the echoes of slavery. It's punitive. There's nothing rehabilitative about it at all. And it leaves the people that go in it more traumatized when they get out than when they went in. And so that becomes an economically foolish system. And so we need to really turn the whole thing upon its head. We need to have a system that, you know, protects their society. And so if people are dangerous, they lose their liberty for a while. But we have to realize that everybody's traumatized. And so once they lose their liberty, everything should be, how do we help this person integrate back to society so they can be a productive member? It literally should be these giant trauma processing machines.
Yeah.
And there's we have so many techniques to help people through trauma, but we don't look at that way at all. And so it's interesting. And listen, the more I dig in, the more angry I get and hopeful I get, because you meet people who are so fucking resilient that even with all the hell they went through, they come out the other side having healed their own trauma. And I'm like, whoa, I can think of, you know, Alex Duran, who works for me, or, you know, Wallow267, I just podcasted, two different, very different characters who went through a very similar process and now are living the most productive lives. And I was like, that they shouldn't be the exception.
Yeah.
They should be the rule. And so that's why I got engaged.
What's the overarching issue? Like, I'm naive about it. I see Netflix documentaries. You see someone going for a parking ticket. They're there for 20 years. But is it that we're optimizing to keep people in prison for long periods of time?
Or? Yeah. You know, we had this war on drugs, war on crime, and it started up this prison industrial complex. If you're a Philadelphia young kid, you get arrested. You don't get sent to Philly prison. You get sent somewhere, middle of Pennsylvania, to a town that is probably a red state, a red county, that now gets extra population because prisoners count as part of the census.
Wow.
And so you have 10,000 young boys from Philly count. They don't vote. So now you got extra red votes. Philly's losing blue votes. You know, you got the guards. Their fathers were guards. Their grandfathers were guards. It's a family business. And it's literally, the prisoners, the inmates, their fathers were in, they were in. It literally is this generational. And so there's this business built around this, which is just horrific. You think about how big the business is. We pay judges, we pay bus drivers, we pay guards, we pay parole officers. You know, if I could wave a wand, I would crush the prison unions today. And I'd crush the police unions. And I'd crush the teachers unions, to be fair. It's funny, I'm as progressive as I am, I think if we could do one thing for America, it would ban public sector unions. And I love private unions. I just don't think public sector unions do any good. They're arguing against who? The taxpayer. And so, yeah, but the real problem is the approach. The moment you start it with a punitive approach, mm-hmm. with a mean-spirited approach, you're lost. In Germany, in Norway, in all of Europe, to run a prison, you need a PhD or at least a master's in rehabilitation. In America, every single prison warden I've met had no degree. Started Jesus. As a guard and worked their way up.
Wow. So what are the examples? Like, I guess, what's the approach? Like, should be able to go to prison and rehabilitate through, like, is it as simple as getting a college degree? Is it simple as changing the environment? Or
I think
it's hard.
It you need at times just a process to deal with your own trauma, right? You need financial education, financial literacy. You need job training, skills training. Often you need, you know, mental health work or anger management, or, you know, you need programs to help yourself reintegrate.
Yeah.
You're not going to get most guys that come in and next thing you know, they're going to Yale. Though I have a friend, Dwayne Betts, jailed to Yale, right? He went to jail at age 15 for 8 years.
15?
Got out 15 for a crime where no one got hurt. Got caught with his friend. They carjacked a guy. They had a small gun. They took the guy's car. 15, 16-year-old, because their friend had left him in a mall. They got caught. 8 and 9 years in jail. It was the same mall I used to actually take the bus to shoplift when I was like, that was like, I had this like adrenaline shoplift. We had no money. My buddy and I would go to this mall and shoplift presents for our siblings. And yeah, I finally got caught, and that was the end of my shoplifting career.
You didn't get Jeff 8 years
later. I got not even a slap on the hand. They cut my fake ID up and sent me home. These, you know, two young black kids went to jail 8 and 9 years. Now, listen, they had a gun. I didn't have a gun, but they didn't hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they should have got nothing, but 15 years old, 8, 9 years. Anyways, Dwayne got it. Dwayne ended up going to Yale Law School. He's one of the smartest guys and just a righteous, you know, son of a gun. And so there's stories like that, but not many.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't need everyone to go to Yale Law School. We just need a process where people can come out and be productive in their citizens and their community again.
There's got to be a massive amount of people that we just never hear about. I could name 5 or 6 off the top of my head that are, you know, exceptions, but there's millions of people in the jail system.
Well, like, we put roughly, there's 5 or 6 million that go through the system every year. God. Every year, right? Jesus. 50% are just for parole violations. Think about that. New York State's the worst state in terms of keeping people in jail for parole violations. Like a parole violation could be you made an illegal U-turn.
Yeah.
It could be you had a dog at your house and your parole officer told you not to have a dog.
And
I mean,
you can't pay bail and then you're stuck.
And so we have a screwed up system. It's just, and it's so hard to change because systems get calcified.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, everyone I talk to is like, of course this should change. You know, we should switch parole officers to life coaches. Parole officer makes about $3,000 per person. Like, we spent about $3,000 per parolee in New York State.
Oh, my God.
And so we took that $3,000 and spent it on a life coach, meet with the guy once a week for 2 hours.
And then people would provide real economic value to the whole economy.
I mean, there's, you know, and everyone's like, of course we should do that, but nothing never changes. And so that's what we're trying to change. Mm-hmm. We're trying to fund programs, you know, pilot programs. We're trying to lobby. We're trying to change the cultural narrative. In lots of different places, in bail and probation, you know, parole, in profiteering in prisons.
Who's got the power to change it in an accelerated timeline? Like, what could be done that changes this in the next?
You know, what was interesting is, like, you would have thought, you know, you had Obama and Eric Holder, right? You had a black president, a black attorney general, and they didn't really get engaged in criminal justice reform till the very end. Trump did a little bit because he kind of, you know, because Jared Kushner's father had been in jail and Jared pushed it. And, you know, listen, they did some good work with the First Step Act. But Trump was so schizophrenic. On the one hand, he's pushing the death penalty back, you know, whatever his whim of the day was, yeah. Whatever he thought made him look good.
Never got the most retweets.
You know, Joe Biden he's got shit to make up for, right? He was part of the crime bill in the late 90s, the Clinton-Klein bill, which caused a lot of the problem. And Kamala was a pretty tough prosecutor. And so, listen, you'd love to see them take a lead on it. But they picked Merrick Garland as the attorney general. He's not a criminal justice reform guy. He's a straight down the middle centrist. And so there's a woman named Kavita Gupta who's one of his assistants. She'd be great. And I hope she will be great. But it takes a bully pulpit. What I've been pushing for is I want them to pick a criminal justice czar. Mm-hmm. That works in the White House like a cabinet officer, says we're going to fix this goddamn broken system and we're going to get it done.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've got some say, but not enough say, evidently.
No, that's totally fair. I need that.
Oh, yeah.
So let's zoom back out a bit. Let's just go to the U.S. You know, obviously criminal justice reform is, things you're doing are amazing. But thinking, if we zoom back out to just the U.S. competitively, when we go back to crypto, regulations, things like that. How do you think about the U.S. maintaining its status as, you know, the world empire. And from a crypto lens, I don't think it's fantastic.
Well, I think you got to start with stable coins. So there's a battle that's going to happen in stable coins, right? And right now, there's more $100 bills in circulation than ones, right? The dollar is the reserve currency of the world. And it's also the currency in all developing places with unstable economies. Yeah. People keep dollars in their mattresses. They keep dollars in bank accounts. They keep dollars offshore. And so as we switch to digital dollars or crypto dollars, it's essential that there's a dollar stable coin that people can, because we have the biggest deficit we've ever had, right? We just added 10% of GDP to the deficit with this $1.9 trillion, you know, supplemental budget four that passed tonight. People don't get it. It's a 10% stimulus.
The numbers get stupid. Yeah.
So how are you going to fund that? You need people to buy your bonds, i.e. buy your dollars. And so in the Treasury gets this now. And so it's why Brian Brook, when he was in the OCC, was pushing hard. It's why I wish I had bought Circle when I had a chance. I think USDC is certainly going to be a contender. I'm really interested to see how Diem, the Facebook project, you know, rolls out. But there's going to be a dollar stable coin because you're going to have to fight the Chinese stable coin. There's a debate that be had about where control of that stable coin blockchain goes, mm-hmm. where control of the privacy stuff goes, right? In China, you got no privacy. And so it's crypto. I remember I did a panel with Sam Lessing. I don't know if you know Sam, but he's
a
brilliant, brilliant early Facebook guy.
I should. You know,
crypto investor. And this was probably 2017. He said, you know, there's just as good of a chance crypto is going to be used to screw us on our privacy than it is to liberate us. And, you know, he's right. There's a battle going to go on, right? Are we going to have an authoritarian version, i.e. China? Are we going to have a freedom version, i.e. US? And what does that freedom version actually mean? What does the government, you know, get to see?
So you don't view it as crypto versus like established economies. You view it as like the US having its free version and then say China having its permission.
Listen, no government is going to give up their right to print currency. They're going to flip from printing paper currency to a cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. If the governments do a shit job of managing the float of that digital or cryptocurrency, right, or paper currency, the world is going to say, ah, I don't trust you. I'll put my money in gold. I'll put my money in Beeple paintings. I'll put my money in Bitcoin. I'll put my money in anything but your shitty dollar, your shitty euro, your shitty yen. We're not there yet. We're not. They haven't lost control. We haven't hit the Minsky moment where people just give up on you know, the Treasury and the Fed. But the probability that we're getting there is going up. And so I think that's why Bitcoin has hit this inflection where now, if you don't own it, you're short.
How do you think that inflection happens, though? Do you think it's a slow grind where, like, crypto is a hedge over the regulator shoulders? Or do you think, like...
Crypto is a report card on the Treasury and the Fed. That's what it is. And if the Treasury and Fed pull off what Ray Dalio used to call a beautiful deleveraging. Right? We have so much leverage in the system. How do you get that out gracefully? Can you run 3% inflation, but not 13% inflation? Can you, if you thread that needle, Bitcoin will hit an equilibrium and then probably not go up.
It seems so unlikely. It seems so hard to do.
I was talking to Ray about this. So Ray wrote a beautiful, beautiful, everyone should read this paper, after the financial crisis, about how you get out of these deleveraging, you know, these, because remember, at the financial crisis, we blew the deficit out. You were probably too young for that, 08.
Lost my $1,000 in high school.
And Ray was now saying, was talking to me, he said, he's skeptical that we'll be able to get out of this without a financial restructuring in the US, which is, you know, almost unheard of. It is unheard of. And so he's pessimistic. And he was not pessimistic in 08.
What does that mean, though? Does that just mean everyone though in crypto is just so much better off and they're gods post this restructuring? Or, I mean, how does that play out?
Well, all of this is in some ways, think of like a pizza pie, right? That used to be 6 inches. Like it was an individual pan pizza, you know, little circle. Because the Fed and Treasury are pouring so much money, that pizza keeps growing, right? Now we've got a fucking, it's 9 feet across in diameter. It's a big fucking pizza. Crypto is becoming a bigger, bigger slice of that pizza. It's not the only asset that's going up, right? This apartment is worth more. The art is worth more. Beeple was worth more. Tesla stock's worth a whole lot more than it was a year ago. Snowflake.
Frisk on.
So all assets are going up. Crypto is just taking a piece of that pie.
Okay.
Right? And so people with assets are getting richer. Oh, fuck. The rich people are getting richer. In general, in old assets, what's good about crypto, at least, is young people are getting richer. Because young people are so screwed with our deficit. I call it generational theft. I stole that term from Stan Druckenmiller. When you look at what the baby boomers have done to the debt, you know, they were supposed to be this woke generation, and they turned out to be the selfish generation. And what they're going to leave Gen Z with, it's an abomination. And there's one stat I love to throw out. I remember talking to Mike Milken about this. He got all mad at me because George Bush, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump were all born the same year. Think about that. Three presidents born the same year. They had 20 years of representation. They're supposed to get 1 year of representation, right? If you think about each year, she get a year of representation. And so the baby boomers had this excess power because there were so many of them. And when they went in, when they were 50, 18% of America was roughly under the poverty line, and 18% of children were roughly under the poverty line. I'm sorry, 18% of seniors and 18% of children. Today, 18% of children are still under the poverty line, but about 3% of seniors are. They paid themselves instead of their grandkids. They literally, the extra hip instead of education. There's not a grandparent I know that would like take a morsel out of their grandkids' mouth and feed themselves consciously, but subconsciously and in practice, that's what happened.
Yeah. It's a crazy stat.
It's an amazing stat.
It's like literally the opposite of what you want.
It's an amazing stat. It's the exact opposite of what you want. And now listen, you can play with the stats a little bit. We had a lot more immigrants come in. They are younger people. And so it's not an apples to apples, but it's a macro that gives you the sense of where the money's going. Yeah. And old people, like, again, are you going to vote to cut Medicare when the bulk of people voting are 60? No. They're going to say, let's expand it. Of course I want my Viagra on Medicare.
It seems so like dog eat dog though. Like, you know, I'm a huge crypto person. Obviously I'm younger. Like, do I just, you know, watch the country burn as I, you know, my crypto goes up? Like, how do I pay for cops and fire departments? Like,
I think about this all the time. You know, do I really want crypto at 500,000? Because if it's 500,000, I wonder what the hell's going on.
You'd be a king on a world on fire.
Well, and this is, listen, I think why you're seeing, I've been doing podcasts with the hip hop community. A, because I find, you know, I like the guys. I find their stories awesome. But B, I just have this sense of trying to provide some financial education to underserved communities that don't get it. And it's amazing. And the first question every hip hop, you know, clubhouse is, what do you think about Dogecoin? I think Dogecoin, it's going down, not up.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, communities get their own information from their community.
Yeah.
And so how do we get better information? So I think it's important for young people to own some Bitcoin, just in case all of them, you know, shit hits the fan. And listen, it's okay that the chair decks get shifted. That this group of people used to be rich. Like, what right did the Vanderbilts have to be rich forever? Or the Rockefellers, right? Like, what is there, some God-given right that, you know, it's like the freaking Queen of England. I want to. You know,
the
royals, right? Like, you know, there's no set of rules that just because you're rich, you get to stay rich. And so, but it's going to be really interesting socially. Again, I looked at that Beeple today, $69 million, and that Justin Sunna did 60. So there were two people willing to pay over $60 million for this piece of digital art. It tells you something. It tells you that some people have made so much money that it's FU money. Yeah. Like, you know, you're throwing away. Like, and because I have this thesis, you don't buy a piece of art unless you're a crazy man for more than 1% of your net worth, right? So that's a billionaire might spend $10 million on a piece of art. Might.
Makes the current valuation stupid.
Right?
Yeah.
That means the guy buying that Beeple was probably worth theoretically $7 to $10 billion. Like, the only people I know ever that have tried to buy art that expensive are deca billionaires.
Jesus. And I mean, they're not even probably consciously buying, right? For them, it's just where to move your assets, right? Or is it, I don't know.
But so either it was a wild man in crypto, or or people have made a lot more money in crypto than we all notice.
Would you ever? Well, let's switch to NFTs for a little. We got like 10 minutes left. What when you think about famous art and value, do you ever think that the Picassos of the world will be NFTs, like from the physical world, or
no.
Are you more bullish on the?
I think you're going to have two different and confusing roads going down. So. There's a guy named Scott Lynn who's got a company called Artworks, right? They take great works of art and fractionalize them. I will sell you 1/100th of that Thornton Dial painting, or a Warhol, or a Banksy, or a Cause, or a Matisse, right? So, and that's becoming an asset class. I want to buy the art index. I have a friend that literally is putting, you know, an 8-digit check into an art index. Right. So just again, it's the same thing. I think they're going to debase currency. I want to own hard assets. Art's a hard asset. He just wants to buy the index. So I think you're going to see the fractionalization. Now, right now, that stuff's not done on the blockchain. It's all done on spreadsheets. It will probably move to the blockchain in time. And if you were smart, you would give someone a digital representation of the physical thing they bought. And it would look like an NFT, but it wouldn't be an NFT. Right. It would just be a replication of a piece of physical art that you own. I think NFTs are here for good. Mm-hmm. I don't think these prices are here for good. I think we're going to have a bubble just like we had an ICO bubble. Whenever there's a supply response like this, when anyone can issue, I thought about issuing my own NFT. And when anyone can just mint an NFT and sell it, you know, but in the long run, you're going to get great digitally native artists who build communities that people say, oh, I got to remember that. You're going to get art that evokes memory and time. So when we're thinking of like sports collectibles, you know, I think of in my era, you know, Joe Namath running off the field with the number one up, or Reggie Jackson hitting 3 home runs in the, you know, game 5 of the World Series. Or so that memorabilia, that art from that day, that moment, I'll pay anything for.
Do you, right? Do you think though that the traditional artwork gets crushed by this because of like, there's so many issues in traditional artwork, right? Like,
no, not at all.
But what about all the, you know, all the stories here about the artwork? It's not real provenance, and the wine bottles are fake, and the, you know, we're pretty too big.
That's still on the fringe. Like, okay. of the 10,000 great pieces of art that transact every couple of years, that's two.
We're just hearing about the people that get screwed.
Yeah. Most people don't get screwed. Listen, there's not as much transparency in the art world. There's a lot of spoofing. And there's a lot of spoofing in the crypto world too.
Oh yeah.
But again, I'm not down on NFTs. I think you need to be really careful what you buy. You're going to, in the long run, only great artists are going to hold value. And those are going to be great physical artists that transition to using, you know, digital as a new medium. When I started this in 2014, talking about crypto and going on the road as a crypto evangelist, I guess, I talked about art almost more than I talked about anything. And I was like, at one point, artists will trust that they'll be able to create and it will not be able to be counterfeited. So for a simple macro guy that's not a computer scientist, the best I ever did with the Satoshi white paper and all the explanations of Bitcoin was it was the first digital asset we couldn't counterfeit, the first digital signature we couldn't counterfeit. And that helped me understand Bitcoin. And then it helped me understand all the other applications of blockchain, right? You know, where I can do IP, where I'm going to do art. And it took art a long time, a lot longer than I thought it would to show up. Now it's shown up in a huge way. It's going to be fascinating. We're investing a ton of money in the space. Not NFTs exactly per se, but all the architecture around them.
I'm jealous of the architecture investments. I'd love to buy OpenSea or Rarible or Super Rare for those guys. Yeah. What do you feel though? You've been through a lot of crypto bubbles. How do you feel though about NFT bubbles? Like, do you think that every kid is going to be playing, you know, Magic Cards, you know, on Gods Unchained instead, or collecting art as NFTs, or yield generating axes? Like,
so I think there's going to be like different lanes. I think something like the $69 million Beeple, like the great art. I think we're really early in that. I think that Beeple is going to come way down. I don't think the great artists. There are some great. You know, blockchain native artists or digital native artists. But most people that have been drawn to art haven't gone into that medium yet because they didn't think they could, and they're all starting. So I've called two young artists I know, and I was like, dude, spend the next 2 months just playing with this stuff for a project I'm working on. And so I think, let's talk in 5 years and we'll see what digital native art really holds value.
Yeah.
Then there's collectibles, right? Mementos, collectibles. That stuff usually is linked to time and memory. Mm-hmm. Babe Ruth's first home run, if it's sports. Or imagine when Travis Scott played that concert on Fortnite.
Oh my God. Yeah, that was
Cause did the album cover, but it wasn't an NFT. If Cause had floated one of his giant balloons over that concert and made it an NFT, everyone who was at that concert, right, the 100 million people, would have seen it and would have said, oh, I got to buy that thing.
It's a really good point. Yeah, it evokes memory. You're there.
That would have immense value because it'll have value in 15 years. I'll remember that was the first one. I remember my first concert. It was Kiss. Pretty freaking cool. AC/DC played backup band. And we were like, get off the stage. We want Kiss.
Get on.
Right? People have memories. Yeah. And so, and then there's a third piece, which are going to be almost consumables. You know, most Top Shop cards. Top Shop's a lottery, right? You're playing the lottery. Other than the good ones, all the other cards just end up being worth nothing, right? Yeah. But there'll be a consumer business of selling digital stuff that people will buy for the dopamine hit for wherever. And not just in sports, but in all kinds of, you know, your CR. I mean, this underlying gaming culture is just going to come to the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of yield generating NFTs. I told you that earlier. It just makes more sense to me because I'm not a big art guy yet. But yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from.
You will be.
Yeah. Hopefully. Mike, this has been incredible. I'm out of questions, man. I really appreciate your time. I want to respect it. Thanks so much for coming on.
I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.